Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
All right. So today we are in a Torah portion of Leviticus. This is Leviticus starting in chapter 9, 10, and 11. Our Torah portion is Shemini. Shemini is starting with 8, referring to eighth day of the sequence of counting, for not for holy day, mind you, but for Aaron and his sons. So Leviticus chapter 9. And I'm not going to cover all the details of 9, 10, 11. In case you are interested, Leviticus 11 discusses most of the details regarding what is and is not clean to eat. So in case you are not sure or have any questions, you're welcome to ask about that topic. That's Leviticus 11. Before we get there, we may or may not get to that today. Oh, hey, look, there's extra sheets there for people in case they're not sure about clean and unclean animals. And mind you, in case you're not sure about this regarding, because our Torah is purposefully non-specific when it comes to birds. So the default has been the birds that are deemed clean are the ones God has already said you can physically eat. Because the descriptions here in chapter 11 of Leviticus, those words that are translated to English, no one really knows what those words mean. So, they're just guesses. So we know the bat is the correct translation, and I believe the eagle is the correct translation, but the rest of them, they really don't know what they are. Anyway, let's go forward. So, Leviticus chapter 9. Now, it's on the eighth day, and mind you, this is the eighth day of Aaron and his four sons' cleansing process for them to become the high priests. On the eighth day, Moses summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. Said Aaron, take for yourselves a young bull for sin offering, a ram for burnt offering, unblemished, and offer them before Jehovah. And the children of Israel speak as follows. Take a he-goat for a sin offering and a calf for the sheep in their first year, unblemished, for burnt offering, and a bull and a ram for a peace offering to slaughter before Jehovah, and a meal offering mixed with oil, for today Jehovah appears to you. They took what Moses commanded the front of the tent of meeting, and the entire assembly approached and stood before Jehovah. Moses said, this is the thing that Jehovah has commanded you to do. Then the glory of Jehovah will appear to you. Moses said to Aaron, come near to the altar, perform the service of your sin offering, your burnt offering, provide atonement for yourselves, the people. Perform the service of the people's offering and provide atonement for them, as Jehovah has commanded. Aaron came near the altar and slaughtered the sin offering calf that was his. And the sons of Aaron brought the blood to him. He dipped his finger into the blood and placed upon the horns of the altar. And he poured the remaining blood upon the foundation of the altar. And the fats and the kidneys and the diaphragm with the liver and the sin offering he caused to go up in smoke on the altar as Jehovah had commanded Moses. And the flesh of the hide he burned in fire outside the camp. He slaughtered the burnt offering. The sons of Aaron presented the blood to him, and he threw it upon the altar all around. They presented the burnt offering to him in its pieces with the head, and he caused it to go up in smoke on the altar. He washed the innards and the feet, caused them to go up in smoke of the burnt offering on the altar. He brought in the offering of the people, took the sin offering goat, for that was for the people. He slaughtered it and performed the sin offering service as for the first one. He brought near the burnt offering and performed its service according to the law. He brought near the meal offering, filled his palm with it, caused to go up in smoke of the altar, aside from the morning burnt offering. He slaughtered the bull and the ram, the people's feast peace offerings. Sons of Aaron presented the blood to him. He threw it upon the altar all around. As for fats, the bull for the ram and the tail, the covering its fats, the kidneys and the diaphragm of the liver, they placed the fats upon the breast, caused the fats to go up in smoke on the altar. Aaron had lifted up the breasts and the right thigh as a wave service before Jehovah, as Moses had commanded. Aaron raised his hands toward the people and blessed them. Then he descended from having performed the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offering. Moses and Aaron came to the meeting. They went out and blessed the people. The glory of Jehovah appeared to the people, the entire people. A fire went forth from before Jehovah and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering, the fats. People saw, sang glad song, and fell upon their faces. We'll stop there for a minute. So, as is tradition for our Torah, and all for how God chose to help compile this regarding the people, so most of your Torah is not written sequentially, it's written subject matter. So in this sequence of events, which you're reading through as far as Aaron offering these offerings up and going and smoking the fire, verse 24, which where God's setting, he's bidding up, burning up, he's setting his fire out to burn him up instead of Aaron putting fire on the altar. But yet we already read that Aaron had put the animals on the altar and burned them up. In the sequence of events is, chapter 9 discusses what Aaron did, the whole sequence, but then 24 is going back in time and discussing where the fire came from. And that sets the stage for chapter 10, which is one of the biggest topics that people talk about for forever and a day, because what on earth happened in chapter 10? Okay, the foreign fire, what is that? That's what our topic will be on today. With chapter 10, we have most of it. Chapter 9 set the stage, so we now know where the fire came from, where the first fire that God decided to cook up all the meat and burn them up into smoke, where that source was. It was from him, not from someone striking a match or creating it on their own for any reason. But note, at the tail of chapter 9, verse 24, it said, the very last verse says, the people saw, sang glad songs, and fell upon their faces. They crossed themselves down to the ground because they saw this fire coming down from heaven to burn up and ignite this. Now this event, this fire event coming down, this inspired Aaron's two oldest sons to do something. That's chapter 10. Let's read that. Inspired from this in chapter 9, the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, each took his fire pan. They put fire in them and placed incense upon it. They brought before Jehovah an alien fire that he had not commanded them. A fire came forth from before Jehovah and consumed them, and they died before Jehovah. Moses said to Aaron, of this did Jehovah speak, saying, I will be sanctified through those who are nearest to me. Thus I will be honored before the entire people. And Aaron was silent. Moses summoned Mishael and Elzaphan, sons of Aaron's uncle Uziel, and said to them, approach, carry your brothers out of the sanctuary, the outside of the camp. They approached and carried them by their tunics to the outs of the camp, as Moses had spoken. Moses said to Aaron and to his two sons, Eleazar and Itamar, do not leave your heads uncut, and do not rent your garments, that you not die. He, referring to God, became wrathful with the entire congregation. And your brethren, the entire house of Israel, shall bewail the conflagration that Jehovah has ignited. Do not leave the entrance to the meeting, lest you die, for the oil of Jehovah's anointment is upon you. And they carried out Moses' bidding. We'll stop there for a minute before we go to verse 8. So we have this basic story. They did all this sacrificing. This is all this happened is on the eighth day. So Aaron and his four sons have been in the tent of meeting for 7 days leading up this point of going through the process of the various sacrifices to do for becoming the generation, the beginning of the entire priesthood, which every priest followed suit. And of course, Messiah being the map of what Aaron is now doing from this point forward. He's a prototype of him. So all this has been occurring for the past 7 days. On the eighth day, when he's finished, I mean, he went through the process. It's the eighth day. All this stuff happens. He brings his sin offerings. We learn in chapter 9. The people's sin offering as well. He has a burnt offering. The people's burnt offering as well. Then a feast piece, which is the offering which everybody eats. They all eat part of the feast or the Shalemim offering. But after he sets them all up, fire comes down, burns it up. Everybody's proud. And then the two sons, the two oldest sons, the four sons are there. It was Aaron, his four sons. There's five men who are living inside the tent of meeting for the past 7 days. And two of them bring their fire pans, put fire on their incense, go before God because they are inspired from this, appears to be inspired from this fire that came down. As, mind you, all the people of Israel are inspired and shocked by seeing the sight. So everyone's like, holy cow, what's just going on? Depending on how you use a cow, maybe holy something else. But the point is, what has happened here? This is shocking. And this is what's so strange to us, at least to me at least. For those two men, they're not boys, they're men. Those two men, they were inspired to do something, which was to bring incense before God. Now, how many of you, now mind you, by the way, in case you're not familiar with or not sure about, don't remember, incense is a metaphor, a symbol for prayers, all right? They are equal to each other. So if you bring incense before, it's you're bringing your prayers before God. It's a sweet-smelling thing. So how many of you would be inspired to praise or pray to God after seeing this sight? Most of us would be, right? I mean, holy cow, seriously. There was a cow there, it's gone. It's all burned up. We'd be inspired to do so, as these two men felt inspired to do this. But what'd God do? Struck him dead. Like, okay, wait a minute. I'm missing something here. Why would God be this wrathful on what seems to be a very minor offense? Well, say the microphone so we can hear you. What'd you say?
I said, I'm thinking it's God's party, not theirs.
That's an interesting point. We're discussing some of these details because I want us to understand this concept well, because what Moses and how he explains to Aaron in this event, what to do, what's going on, Moses then argues the precise opposite to God in the book of Numbers. He advocates the opposite position. So we'll discuss these. When our Bibles contradict itself in different spots, that's the best place to learn what God's doing. To give you a deeper picture. You have two conflicting stories, two conflicting perspectives, that they do not agree with each other, but yet God did them both. It's okay, what's going on? Let's understand our God deeper than we did before. We're going to discuss these things today. Yes, Larry.
Well, he did something he did not tell them to do.
Correct. He did something they did not tell them to do.
In other words, they were trying to do it their way, not his way.
And that's what we're going to learn about, doing those things their way versus his way. And at what point he says, that's too far, I'm going to strike you. Or he says, that's okay, I'm not going to strike you at this point. We're going to learn and see some of those stories, that God has a threshold, which I do not fully understand. He has a threshold. He says, I'll let you go this far, but no further. And sometimes I would look at threshold, well, my threshold's here and his is there. And sometimes mine's here and his is over here. Each of his thresholds are different. We're going to explore some of these when it comes to executing somebody on their offense. Yes.
In this case, isn't there some controversy that maybe they were inside? They were inside the tabernacle. Were they inside the Holy of Holies when they did this?
So if you go through all the bazillion different commentaries about this chapter, one of the most commentated sections there are in Leviticus, there's tons of stories created to try to explain what happened. From being drunk, to being inside the Holy of Holies section, to having an accident. It was a grease fire by accident, something got out of control. But the lot of different things people have pitched and thought about what could cause and what God did and why it had happened. No one really knows. It's not told to us because God didn't want us to know. If you wanted more detail, we would learn. But I will say this. The term used, alien fire, is used a number of different times in your Bible. It's actually, my mother had pointed out last night when I was talking to her. It's the same phrase used for offensive. It's an offensive event. It's an offensive fire. So God was offended by this fire they decided to bring up. Now, was it because the source of the fire was the problem? Meaning they grabbed a fire from somewhere else and lit it? Or was it the fact that they brought their incense forward and the smoke and fire in front of him, because that's the act of doing that process? we don't know which one was most offensive to him. But we can learn a few things about this and help us narrow down some of his details. One of the things I want to point out is that Moses' explanation, or not explanation, more like his instruction to Aaron after this, is that in verse 3, it says, "I will be sanctified," which means set aside, "through those who are nearest to me. Thus, I will be honored before the entire people." So this is the supposed explanation that Moses gives to Aaron as to what happened. So I have a question for you. Is offering incense to God respectful? Is offering incense to God honorable? Okay, so those two, the act itself is not offensive. How do we know that? He told us to do it. We know the act themselves, the offering of incense to a praise or prayer to God, that's not offensive to him. It is not dishonorable to him in any way. But in this instance, God did not feel or not perceive this was an honorable, or it was not a respectful act. We don't know which one. Could be both. But it's one of the two or the other. God thought it was not honorable or was not respectful. Now, honor, to raise something up higher than it would normally be, were they lowering God in this act? No, I didn't think they were lowering him. They were offering incense to him. That is a showing of honor. So my personal opinion, this is Daniel H.'s opinion, don't agree. I don't think it was the act of honor that God was upset with. My personal opinion, Daniel Agee's opinion, was it was the other one, the respect. That, I think, was what God was more upset with at that moment in time. And the only reason I think that is because offering incense is not a dishonorable thing. And it can be a disrespectful thing if you don't do it right. Go to Numbers chapter 22. I'm sorry, 22:16. That 22 is later. Go to Numbers 16. So Numbers 16, I'm going to read the entire story. You know the story very, very well. I want to bring these events to you. This is, of course, a story of Korah. Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, separated himself with Dathan, Abiram, and sons of Elam, and On, son of Peleth, the offspring of Reuben. They stood before Moses with 250 men of the children of Israel, leaders of the assembly, those summoned for meeting, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, "It is too much for you. The entire assembly, all of them, are holy, and Jehovah is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of Jehovah?" Moses heard and fell on his face. He spoke to Korah and his assembly, saying, "In the morning, Jehovah will make known the one who is his own and the Holy One. He will draw him close to himself, and whomever he will choose, he will draw close to himself. Do this. Take for yourselves fire pans, Korah and his entire assembly, put fire in them and place incense upon them before Jehovah tomorrow. Then the man whom Jehovah will choose, he is the Holy One. It is too much for you, O offspring of Levi." Now we know the story. What's going to happen? So, of course, Moses is upset with Korah, and we're going to go through all the story. We'll jump down a little bit in a moment. Moses is upset with Korah. Korah is upset with Moses and Aaron, and Korah is challenging him. So you shouldn't be, you've taken too much upon yourself. This is more than what you deserve or what you've done. It's too high, too great of an honor for you. So in the case of Korah, what is the instruction? What does Moses wind up having Korah and his men do? They took the fire pans, as it was commanded. Let's jump down to verse 16. Moses said to Korah, "You and your entire assembly be before Jehovah, you, they, and Aaron tomorrow. Let each man make his fire pan, and you shall place incense on them. You shall bring them before Jehovah, each man with his fire pan, 250 fire pans, you and Aaron, each man with his fire pan." So they took each man his fire pan, they placed fire upon them, and put incense on them. They stood at the entrance of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Korah gathered the entire congregation, assembly, against them to the entrance of the meeting, and the glory of Jehovah appeared to the assembly. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Separate yourselves from amidst this assembly. I will destroy them in an instant." They fell on their faces. "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the entire assembly?" Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the assembly, saying, get yourselves up from all around the dwelling place of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." Moses stood up, went to Dathan and Abiram. The elders followed him. He spoke to the assembly, saying, "Turn away now from near the tent of these wicked men. Do not touch anything of theirs, lest you perish because of all their sins." They got themselves up from near the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, from all around. Dathan and Abiram went out erect to enter the tents of their tents with their wives, children, and infants. We'll stop there for a minute. So we know what's going to happen, right? Remember the story. You know, the earth opens up and everybody gets swallowed up. So in the case which we have going on in this story, we're going to contrast that to Aaron and his sons. So is the act of bringing a fire pan and incense an offense to God? Aaron's doing it. Was God angry at Aaron for doing this in this instance? No indication of that. The act of bringing a fire pan and incense is not a dishonor to God. But what is God? What is in the heart of Korah and his friends? Rebellion. So whether the act of incense, Rebellion's correct, the act of incense wasn't the problem. It's their respect to God and to Aaron and Moses for what the office they held. So in this instance, what does God wind up doing? Anybody remember? Fire comes out and cooks Korah and his men, and the earth opens up and swallows up Dathan and Abiram and their whole families. So we learn that the act of God striking Korah and the men who were with him, 250 who had their fire pans, God uses the same technique that he killed Aaron's two sons with. It was not the fire pan itself is the sin. And since Aaron's doing the exact same thing as Korah, the act of bringing a fire pan is not a dishonor to God, because Aaron was not dishonoring him, and Korah was obeying instructions. Obeying instructions is an honor to someone. But the heart of Korah and his men were rebellious. So they were still, though they were honoring, they were not respectful. And since I'm using the same analogy that God appeared to strike Nadab and Abihu, their execution, it wasn't an honor thing about the fire pan. There was some respect issue that God addressed Korah with. There's probably, Daniel's opinion, a respect issue that happened with Aaron's two sons. There's something that God correlated to the two of them. Yes, Pat.
God can always see the heart attitude, and they were willing to do certain things, but they were not willing to submit to Moses' leadership or Aaron's leadership. And basically, the sons were not obeying their leadership either.
Right. The sons were supposed to be there, the closest, in quotes, closest other than Aaron himself, because God said, "Who is nearest to me, I'll be honored and respected." That means who is farthest from me, does he need honor and respect from them? No. He requires honor and respect from the ones who is nearest to him. Aaron and his four sons were all nearest to God because they had just completed their process of purification. They were ending that process to pass it through, and now they're going to be official priesthood for all ever, forever. That was the intent. They had finished it. They were going to be the nearest people you could get to God. You couldn't get any closer. And those God required the most of, in this case, was honor and respect, which the two sons did not follow. Now, when it comes here with Korah, they were required to come approach the tent of meeting. You're supposed to come really close to do that. You bring out your fire pan, so they're all getting close. So they are now bringing themselves nearest, quote-unquote nearest, to God. Well, what does God require? As we learn from Dathan and Abiram, you must be honor and respect. The closer you get, the more honor and respect you must offer or have to this individual you're speaking with. So we have this contrast, and clearly that Korah and his sons did not show the honor, the respect part. They had the honor. They did the actual act. They followed the sequence. Because the act itself was a duplicate of what Aaron did, so the act was not different, but the inner heart wasn't there. So something was wrong with Korah and his group. And my opinion, Daniel's opinion, that on Nadab and Abihu, something else was wrong inside them as well. Whatever that was, I don't know, but something was off inside their offering. Make sense? Yes, Rose.
I was just thinking that as a new Christian, that God is working with you, his tolerance level is much higher than, say, like me. I've been walking this way for 50 years.
You have a narrow gap.
And if I'm still and if I'm still acting like that new Christian, I'm in trouble. I mean, I should be at a deep, deep walk.
Yep.
And I am with the Lord.
Mature, right.
So I equate that to that. You know,
it is very similar, and actually we're going to discuss some of those examples in our discussion today, those precise topics. Because sometimes when you are closest to God, you will notice that his striking out seems abrupt and quick and harsh. And yet those who are furthest from God, who do far, far worse things, his tolerance level is enormous. It has almost non-caring practically, those who are the furthest away. So we see these contrasts. The closer and closer you get, the more mature you are, you have a new minimum. Your minimum behavior is now brought up to a new minimum level. It's expected of you to, the closer you get, guess what? You have more expected from you. We get the term from the Messiah. The more granted from you, the more is expected from you. So the closer you get to God, the more is expected from you. The further away you are, less, far, far less is expected. So God has this graduating scale, so to speak. He has this written down exactly what he requires. Hey, here's my list. I expect all these behaviors. And now how far away you are from them, more leniency is given as you're slowly walking closer and closer and closer. But those who are already there or near to it, it's harsh when you make mistakes because you know better.
Yeah. I would just like to say that I received a correction from my husband. And he said, Rose, you're in college. I'm in kindergarten. Give me a break. So I had to take that into consideration because I can't expect him to be where I am.
It would be improper.
I've been walking this way for so long.
And I wouldn't expect a child to be the same thing as an adult. It just we expect less of our children, right? Obviously, because their work they're growing through. So we already do that naturally.
I'm thinking who's more mature.
Well, that's for you and him. I won't discuss those details. So see you on. There's a few more details I want to cover today regarding this particular topic because there's two topics I want to discuss and how this is going to work. We're going to discuss the first topic, which has to do with God and dealing with quick versus slow reactions. So let's go to an example, I should say, of a relatively slow response because this Nadab and Abihu was a quick response. All right, once they did it, God strikes him. There wasn't like a warning. Moses didn't say, hey guys, don't do that. It was a bam, you're gone. There was nothing else given to them. That was it. So let's go to some who get some warnings and get some long lead times. So let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 2. We know this story well. We've all discussed it and read it probably since we were children. 1 Samuel chapter 2, starting in verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know Jehovah. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. He would thrust it into the pan or the kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself all the flesh hook had brought up. So they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come by and say to the man who sacrificed, give meat for roasting, the priest, for we will not take boiled meat from you but raw. And if the man said to him, they should really burn the fat first, then you may take as much as your heart desires. He would then answer him, "No, but you must give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force." Therefore, the sin of the young man was very great. Was very great for Jehovah, for the men abhorred the offering of Jehovah. Let's jump down to verse 22. We're focusing on Eli and his sons, not Samuel himself. Verse 22, as we continue on. Now, Eli was very old. He heard everything that his sons did to all of Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. He said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if man sins against Jehovah, who will intercede for him?" But nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of Father because Jehovah desired to kill them. Let's stop there for a minute. So we have this story of Eli and his son, the corrupt behavior of his sons. And Eli supposedly, I guess you can call it chastised, meaning he told them you shouldn't do that, as far as the behavior. Now, Eli is a high priest, right? Just like Aaron is high priest in the story with the Torah portion. Eli has two misbehaving sons. Aaron had two sons. Note the long delay for God striking Eli and his sons compared to Aaron's sons. Now, this story is starting out with Samuel's a very young boy. Well, Samuel grows up, so years are going to go by as these slowly accumulate over time. This behavior these two sons are doing and how Eli is dealing with them progress for decades before God finally says, "Now's the time. Now I'm going to go ahead and strike them." Now, that may seem strange because in Aaron's case, were his sons given warnings? No. Training, that's true, but Eli's sons, they were already trained, theoretically. They're already trained, the training's complete. But they received warnings and yet did not heed them. And long periods of time go by. So you ask yourselves, God, why is it that you give a long period of time to Eli and his sons to change or to improve their behavior compared to a short warning for Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's two sons? Well, we should ask ourselves the obvious question that follows that. Which one's closer to God? Which one's further away? Yes.
In the case of Abihu and
Abiram and Nadab and Abihu. Nadab and Abihu. Yes.
That this was just the beginning of the tabernacle, and this was the very first offering that was burned up by the Lord, and the people were assembled, and everybody saw. Well, Eli's sons, they did stuff right at the door of the tabernacle, it says, you know, the people saw that. But
the people saw it. The people would see them both because they were there at the door as well. The people were there at the door of the tabernacle for Eli.
Right.
That's true.
But that first sacrifice, the Lord brought the fire down and he burned it up. And the glory of the Lord was everywhere. I mean, the people could see that from outside.
That's right. They could see it. That is true.
So those that are at, you know, with Eli, that was no longer happening where God was burning it up. I mean, right? I mean,
as far as we know, we don't know because it's not sure whether you could still, not the fire coming down, but whether you could still see God's presence or not. I don't know. The reason I say I don't know is because when Solomon builds his temple, he says, "God, you'll only build dwell in dark clouds. The cloud comes and fills it up." So clearly there's something that people could see, maybe not on a regular basis, but maybe occasionally, the presence or a cloud that was maybe near or around it. Now, in Eli's case, this tabernacle is still the same tent fabric structure that was with Moses' time. They may have done some repairs over the years, but it's still the same basic structure. So I'm not sure how much, there were less people surrounding, the tabernacle at this time for Eli versus for Aaron. I would speculate, just speculating, that God, as I see him with other characteristics, I went this example on purpose because we're contrasting the short, quick response to Aaron's sons and the long, drawn-out response to Eli and his sons, and contrast the two of them. there's more examples of these citations. Long suffering versus short suffering. There's some things that God says, this is my threshold, don't cross it, and some, my threshold is further away. So let's go into the one that's a short response. There's a short response, a quick response. We're still in 2 Samuel. Go to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 6 is an example of a short response from God. 2 Samuel chapter 6, starting in verse 1. And this is the transportation of the Ark of the Covenant. Now again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000. Now mind you, this example of many people around. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah up to bring up the ark of God, whose name was called by the name of Jehovah, Jehovah hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. So they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out to the house of Abinadab, which is on the hill. And Uzzah and Iho, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart. They brought it out to the house of Abinadab, which is on the hill, accompanying the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. Then David and the house of Israel played music before Jehovah on all kinds of instruments made of fir wood and harps and stringed instruments, tambourines and sistrums and all the cymbals. And they came to Nachal's threshing floor. Uzzah put out his hand, the ark of God, and took hold of it, for the oxen had stumbled. Then the anger of Jehovah was aroused against Uzzah. God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. David became angry because of Jehovah's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of Jehovah that day. He said, "How can the ark of Jehovah come to me?" So David would not move the ark of Jehovah with him into the city of David. David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The ark of Jehovah remained the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. Jehovah blessed Obed-Edom and all of his household. Now here's an example of someone who was trying to do what was right. Now, he was not the king. Uzzah was just a man who was helping to transport. The king dictated what happens with the cart and everything else. David decided it. So David set the stage how the parade was going to happen. And so these men are following suit, following the king's instructions. But an ox stumbles, and one of the men, seeing this ark apparently if the ox is stumbling, the ark is going to fall. It's going to fall and strike the ground. And though maybe plated with gold, it's still a wood box. It's going to get damaged when it hits that ground. So what's his instinct? Stop it from falling. Now, was it his fault for doing so? No. It would not be his fault. Did he do something wrong? In God's eyes, he wasn't supposed to touch it. Okay. And then we can speculate. Oh, well, God could have saved his box, and Uzzah could have just watched it. Uzzah did the same thing that I'm sure everybody in this room would have done. Our instinct. Oh, no. It's our instinct. Save it. Don't let it hit the ground. Don't cause damage to one of God's property items. That's an important thing. It's our instinct to do so. God did not say, Uzzah, you're not supposed to do that. What did he do? He's dead. No warning on him. Yes, Larry.
Well, the ark was not supposed to be on a cart.
Correct.
The first place.
And David didn't research and read the Torah ahead of time and ask, how am I supposed to transport this? But whose fault is that? I don't know. You could argue it's just David. Maybe Uzzah should have known and said, hey, by the way, David's not supposed to do this. I don't know. Maybe whoever didn't inform him or David wasn't listening. Who knows? It's all David. But David got a lot of people in trouble. He did. So Uzzah gets struck for this without a warning, no guiding hand saying, oh, no warning at all. He has immediate strikes. We have an example of Nadab and Abihu, immediate strike from God, no warning. We have Eli and his sons, long, lengthy warnings going over and over and over and over and over again and again and again and again, nonstop, before they finally, after decades go by, God finally says, I've had enough. Kill them too. And then Uzzah, who seemingly did an innocuous thing, tried to stop the ark from falling. No warning, he dies. So we have this contrast of how God's dealing with individuals. They're very different, aren't they? These are not the same way of dealing with people. Yes, Larry.
You know, I'm thinking this may not be that striking them immediately may not be as bad a punishment as other things.
That very well may be. That is possible.
He can resurrect them, after all.
Right. Death is a temporary state of being for as far as God's concerned. It's not a permanent thing. To us, it's very permanent. Let's go to another example. This is an example of a relatively... Unless you want to go there. Yeah, we'll go there too. Go to 1 Kings, chapter 19. This example of other individuals who do the wrong thing, I guess you can call it. 1 Kings 19, this of who are a slow or progressive way of God dealing with people. So we have contrast of quick versus slow responses. So 1 Kings 19, we know the story very well. I'm sure you all have read it dozens and dozens of times. Go to verse... I'm not going to do the miracle of the Mount Carmel part, the part where Elijah is fleeing. So 1 Kings 19, First Kings 18 discusses, you know, the fire coming down from heaven and burning up the altar and also around there and try to and they wind up killing a bunch of prophets of Baal. So that was the previous chapter, but chapter 19 discusses the response of Elijah. Verse 19 says, "And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. And Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, 'So that the gods do to me and more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time.' When he saw that, he arose, ran for his life, went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey to the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. He prayed that he might die and said, 'It is enough now, Lord. Take me my life, for I am no better than my father's.' Then as he lay, slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said, 'Arise, eat.' He looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of Jehovah came back a second time and touched him and said, 'Arise, eat. The journey is too great for you.' So he arose and ate and drank. He went in strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights, as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. And there he went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of Jehovah came to him and said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' And he said, 'I have been very zealous for Jehovah, God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek my life.' He said, 'Go out, stand on the mountain before Jehovah, and behold, Jehovah passed by, and a great and strong wind tore in the mountains and broke in rocks and pieces before Jehovah, for Jehovah was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but Jehovah was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but Jehovah was not in the fire. After the fire, a still small voice. So when Elijah heard it, they wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the edge of the cave. And suddenly, a voice came out to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' So he said, 'I have been very zealous for Jehovah, God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant and torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life.' He said, then Jehovah said to him, 'Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. Should whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. Whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, every mouth that has not kissed him.'" Stop there for a minute. I read this story because I want you to remember the story that's going on in Elijah. He's a prophet of the northern tribes of Israel. Now, King Ahab is the king. He's been king for a lot of years, and the people have progressively gotten worse and worse and worse as the generations and years have gone by. God has not struck them all those, not just years, but rather generations, he has not struck. So we have a case of a God saying, God allowing people who are farther from him a longer rope, so to speak, to work with. He gave more leeway. Those who are closer, we got the multiple examples of God. The closer you are to God, the shorter your rope is. The shorter, your gap. As far as with Nadab and Abihu, there was no warning. They were struck dead. Uzzah, no warning, just touched it, the ark, and he dropped dead. No warning. They were the closest to God. Yet those who are further away, Eli, who was supposed to be close, but he wasn't, he and his sons had many decades, and God gave them a long time to recover, almost their whole lives, and they failed to do so. Before finally God said, enough's enough, I'm going to strike you for this. And we have Elijah, who's he alone is left. People have all been murdered. Many of them have, not all, but they've been murdered. They've all left God completely. God has allowed, those of you who know the story of northern tribes of Israel, it was a progressive sequence of getting worse. Who could out-worse the other guy? Who could be worse the guy before him, kind of thing, of never-ending cycles. And what did God do? Allow them to keep on going. So it appears the further away you are from God, the more lenient God is to you on what your mistakes are or errors in your way. That's what it appears to be. So, well, that seems strange. Is it? Is it really that strange, though? The more you are given, the more is expected. So the closer you are to God, the more is expected. You get a little closer, that's fine. Your conduct becomes more apparent, more obvious. He starts looking closer at you. It's a lot like, if you imagine, this is how I imagine it. Imagine you're on a mountaintop. And you're seeing a hill, a mountain range, far, 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 far away. How much detail can you see? Very little. You can see those mountains, you might see colors, but not a lot of detail from a far away distant mountain range. But the closer it gets, can you see more detail? Yes. So the closer we get to God, what are we doing? We're allowing God to see more detail. It's a metaphor. I'm just using it as an example. But the point is, the closer you are to him, the more scrutiny he can observe and see. And it's apparent to each one of us, isn't it? How about in your lives? The further away you were, the more mistakes or errors of thought or whatever you did were different than they are the closer you get, isn't it? It's strange how that works, but that's how God's working. So although God wrote his Torah out, said, this is my list of what I expect, the further away you are from it, the more lenient he is until you start getting closer and closer and closer and closer. He says, okay, now let's start putting some of these things and say, let's get some more observant on your conduct. Let's watch how you handle yourself and the people around you. We ask ourselves, why? Doesn't God forgive everything? He forgives everything. He forgives everybody. What does it matter? Does it matter? Why do you think it matters? Mind you, right, flesh and blood cannot. Pay attention to the stories in our Bible. Are they written about any Tom, Dick, and Harry? Are the stories about written about any Tom, Dick, or Harry? No. Who are the stories about? Those who are either unrighteous, those who are righteous, or those who are in between. There's somewhere in between the two. They're about those characters. The closer the person got to God, mind you, here's an example, King David. How harsher was God on him? Much harsher, wasn't he? Contrast that to the kings that were after David who were far, far worse than David. How harsh was God on them? Not so much in comparison. And with Moses, the striking of the rock and saying, Moses, you bring forth water from this. Now, that's a very minor offense, we may say, but God said, that's enough, you're dead. After a while, but still, it was toward the tail end of 40 years, the latter half. He was like, oh, I was just there, that close. Goes, no, I'm snatching it from you. Not good enough. So God, the closer you get, the more he expects. We may think, that's so hard on us. Is it? What's the benefit of getting closer to God? Doesn't it seem like it's more difficult? Why would I want to go get closer to him? I'll just stay away from him, right? Yeah. Yeah, you get more blessings the closer you get to him, don't you? It's like, okay, this is dangerous to me. For example, I'm cold outside. There's a fire over there. I get closer, I get warmer, but I get burned too. So it's advantageous to me. It's a blessing to get closer, but beware, there's danger there. So it's the same principle of God. He's no different. That's why he uses the term fire a lot of times to describe himself. And it's the same simile. It's beneficial, but beware, it comes to risks. And pay attention, the closer you get, the more responsibility is required. So Larry, go ahead, your comment.
Yeah, there's a couple of other things that I'm thinking about when you're talking about here. First of all, David, for as many mistakes as he made, and he was very long-suffering with him, but his life was miserable. His family life was miserable because of what he did, starting with the Hittite, Uriah.
Yep.
And then Apostle Paul brought that out later on when he said, people do these things and they think they're getting away with them because God's not swift in his punishment. And you get a chance to essentially go and destroy yourself if you're not paying attention.
Exactly. Now, and we use an example, and we can see the stories that God had compiled for us in our Tanakh and throughout the New Testament as well, of the characters we're reading about. The more interesting the character, the more dynamic they went from extremes, from good to bad, and back and forth, and back and forth. There's a lot more stories written about them because they did such things. We learn about those stories. And so those individuals, we can't see our own mistakes. Well, this person got away with it. I'll keep on doing it. He didn't strike me today. I'm not like Nadab and Abihu. I lived through this, so it must not have been that bad. He must not have been that concerned. He didn't really care about it. And that brings another story, another example in our Torah portion, because I'm going to move on to the topic in a moment. In our Torah portion, in the example of which verse was it? In chapter 10 of Leviticus, in verse 16 and 17 through 20. We go back to Leviticus 16. Chapter 10. Go back to Leviticus 10. Sorry. Now, this is another offense that God was not concerned with. And we'll discuss a little bit why. Because this is our second topic we're going to lead into, because there's two main things I want to discuss today about the Torah portion before I call it quits. So second portion is Leviticus chapter 10, starting in verse 16. Moses inquired insistently about the he-goat of the sin offering, for behold, it had been burned up. And he was wrathful with Eleazar and Itamar, Aaron's remaining two sons, saying, why did you not eat the sin offering in a holy place? For it is most holy. And he gave it to you to gain forgiveness for the sin of the assembly and to atone for them before Jehovah. Behold, its blood was not brought into the sanctuary within. You should have eaten it in the holy as I commanded you. Aaron spoke to Moses. Was it they who this day offered their sin offering and their burnt offering before Jehovah? Now, that such things have befallen me, were I to eat this day's sin offering, would Jehovah have approved? Moses heard, and he approved, or he relented. So we have an example of, even though Nadab and Abihu offered these pans, these fire pans, they were struck dead. These other two sons, Eleazar and Itamar, they were supposed to offer a sin offering in a particular way, and they didn't. Instead of eating it, they just burned the whole thing up. That's a defense. God said, don't do that. He had instructions. Did God strike them dead for it? No. Did God even say anything? No. Moses was concerned, clearly, but God wasn't. So he said, okay, God, where is your threshold? What was important and what wasn't? Well, in this instance, God clearly thought this was not important. And Aaron's response of, hey, would God have even accepted this offering because of his own personal state of mind, state of being? Would God have accepted it? And Moses relented. Probably not. God probably would have been more upset had you eaten it. Moses doesn't know. He doesn't specify that's the case. We're speculating. Either way, Moses relented. He stopped the inquiry. So we have example of his, this is all the same day, by the way. Nadab and Abihu died earlier that day. This is all the same exact day that this event, these events are occurring. So all one event, or as far as one occurrence. So he loses two sons, and this event, of course, occurs. It's all the same day, all the exact eighth day. Aaron's just a brand spanking new, minted high priest. All this exact event. So this is a hard event for him. We have the example, of course, of God saying, well, this is obviously a non-important offense compared to the more important offense, which was Nadab and Abihu's offense. Why was this not important? I have a really good idea, but I can't prove it. So I don't know if I'll share it or not. We'll see. Yes, Larry.
Well, he probably was not in the right frame of mind.
Probably not.
And that reminds me of Cain and Abel. Cain gave what seemed
right.
like a perfectly
they're,
good.
They're he was both the offerings right exactly. Both offerings were fair. Nothing wrong with either one of them. But 100 incorrect state of mind on his offering, and that was enough. God said, "I'm not going to take it. I'm not accepting it." Which is the exact same principle. Now, what I want to point out to my personal opinion about this, my Daniel Age's opinion. Don't have to agree with me. That's fine. This sin offering was a sin offering for the people. This that they didn't eat. Aaron had already given his sin offering for himself. So the sin offering for himself was taken care of. Sin offering for the people was not corrected. And I want to point that out to you because Aaron is an example of our high priest, the Messiah, right? And he is going to be our sin offering himself. So in Aaron's case, his sin offering was perfect. The people's sin offering was not. So my opinion, I think this is an allusion to Messiah's being his sin offering, that it being perfect, and ours not being. But that's just my personal opinion, just an opinion. Let's move on to another topic, an extension of this topic, because of something Moses says and his contrast in his opinion or how he argues this. We had read part of it earlier, but I want to highlight this. This is an important concept before we call it quits for today. Let's see here. Early in Leviticus chapter 6, there's something Moses had said. Leviticus 10, verse 6. It says, Moses to Aaron and his sons, this is back when they had died, when the two sons had died. Do not leave your heads unshorn, do not rend your garments that you not die, and he become wrathful with the entire assembly. And your brethren, the entire house of Israel, shall bewail the conflagration that Jehovah has ignited. Do not leave the entrance to the meeting, lest you die, for the oil of Jehovah's anointment is upon you. And they carried out Moses' bidding. And verse 6 says, do not leave your heads unshorn, do not rend your garments, lest you not die. And he become wrathful with the entire assembly. Okay, wait a minute. Let's think about that for a minute. So Aaron and his sons, the two remaining sons are still alive. Don't let your hair grow long. Not to grow really long in a day, but whatever it is. Or don't mess it up, don't make it look bad. Lest God become wrathful with the entire assembly out there, and you guys are over here. Let God be wrathful on all of them. We should think about this. Now, wait a minute. So the act of Aaron and his two remaining sons, their act of mourning or being upset or saddened, God would bring us, Moses' warning is, God may bring us wrath upon all the assembly because of it. Now let's go back to Numbers 16, because Moses argues the precise opposite to God. In Numbers 16, which we read earlier, read it again. There's a highlight there I want to bring out to you. This is a strange discussion that God, Moses is having. It's an important one. Number 16, jump to verse 20. God is talking to Moses and Aaron regarding Korah. Number 16, verse 20, it says, Jehovah spoke to Moses and Aaron saying, separate yourselves from the assembly, I shall destroy them in an instant. Verse 22, they fell on their faces and said, O God, God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the entire assembly? And of course, in verse 23, God said, speak to the assembly saying, get yourselves around for the dwelling of just these individuals. So we have the case of Moses. We talked to Aaron, who lost his sons. Moses says, don't mess yourself up, because if you do anything wrong, God might be angry with the entire assembly and kill everybody, or his wrath, what he decides to do, kill, hurt, whatever, who cares. Upset with everybody, the wrath of everybody. So it's one man telling one man, don't screw up, because if you screw up, everybody's going to punish from it. Then he goes over in Korah's time, talks to God, and says, God, why would you mess everybody up for one man's screw up? And God relents at the time of Korah and says, oh, okay, we'll just focus on the individuals alone. This is an important idea to focus on, that this idea of, and Moses is talking to Aaron initially, you're one man. If you screw up, everybody suffers. But when it comes to Korah, Korah screws up. Wait a minute, God, nobody else should suffer. Just focus on Korah alone, and of course, his cohorts, the ones with him. There's an important understanding of what's going on in these two categories. Yes, Tammy.
I think it's the same reason that when Miriam and Aaron were backstabbing Moses, Aaron didn't get punished physically.
Right.
Miriam did.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same thing, if Aaron and his sons had decided to just dishevel themselves or cut themselves or do whatever, the reason that the congregation would be punished for it rather than Aaron is the same reason that Miriam was punished rather than Aaron's, because Aaron could not be seen as being imperfect physically.
That is true.
Him down with leprosy, or God punishing him in some physical manner that would put a mark on him, would mar the whole point of what the high priest was supposed to symbolize.
That is absolutely true observation. It's important because there's a huge difference between Aaron and Korah. These are not the same office being held. Though Korah wanted the office, they aren't the same. Yes, Pat.
I was going to say, because God had put Aaron in such a high place of leadership, he had a very different example to set for everyone as compared to other people.
Right. And that example is how our Messiah is supposed to be perfect, right? He needed that. In order for him to be our, quote, high priest, in a quote, use that term, I use it for my own reasons. But he has to be perfect, without spot or blemish. So he has to have everything to be just right. If he makes a mistake, what happens?
We're
all done, right? If Messiah was in error at any point in time before he passed away, then he died not for our sins, rather for his own. Then what would happen? Then God's wrath upon all of us, and we are just pathetic creatures of the lowest scum there ever is, because we thought we could do anything now and just say, well, he died for us, we're all good. In fact, he died for his own sins, and we're all screwed up now. And we have been for generations. So, In the case we have this incident, one man, because the office he held mattered. Korah's office he held, didn't hold an office, didn't matter. So in his case, he said, you die for your own sins. It's your own problem. Don't suffer anybody. But Moses recognized the high priest, however, couldn't have that leeway, couldn't have that flexibility of error or mistake. Even though Korah's mistake was far, far worse than Aaron's, in my personal opinion, disrespecting God versus, messing your hair up, I don't know. One could argue which one's worse. I have my opinions. But God had, Aaron's office had to be perfect. Else the whole offering meant nothing. So in the Messiah's case, he has to have a perfect life, else his offering was nothing. Does it make sense? Hopefully it does. So we have these examples of how we learn that one man can do a lot of damage or can do no damage at all. We have an example also of Adam and Eve, right? One man doing a lot of damage. And we say, well, he wasn't high priest. Yes, actually, in a matter of fact, he was. He was the only priest, holy anything. So he was everything, and then he screwed up. So guess what? Did all the congregation suffer after Adam?
Yes.
Yes. So we have an example of one man screwing up made everybody suffer. So if the high priest screws up, everybody suffers. If an ordinary person who isn't in that office screws up, well, he suffers or she suffers. There's a big difference between the two of them, how God deals with these examples. So again, It's no different than the Nadab and Abihu and all the quick response versus slow response. Adam and Eve's response, how quick was God with that one? Very quick, because guess what? You did something wrong, and instantly they knew their eyes were opened. Oh, now we know. That was fast, wasn't it? Quick response. High priest screw-ups, generally with the exception of Eli, are normally quick responses, but Eli himself wasn't the criminal, so to speak, or the bad guy, though he was a terrible father. His sons were. His sons had big issues there. We can discuss Eli in more in depth at another time. But we have high priests have very important critical roles. They're not allowed to be messed up. Else all the work they do is truly worthless. And all those people, let's say I was Joe Schmidt number 7, I came up and offered my cow last week for a sin that I did, and the high priest did all this process, and the high priest was an awful, horrible sinner. I don't know that. So I think God accepted my offering. Having no knowledge, God didn't. Because the guy who did it was a messed up life. So I go all my life thinking, oh, I'm good with God. God's pleased with me. Having no clue, God rejected my offering wholly. Because the guy who was supposed to do it and do it correctly was an awful human being. And I didn't know. Or I did know. Either way, if I did know, that's even worse. But there was, I didn't know. And so those when the high priest doesn't do the job correctly or isn't right with God, it doesn't just affect the high priest alone, does it? Every individual who came to them to go through their process, they think they are right with God. And in fact, they're not. And do not know it. That's what Apostle Paul had warned. If this isn't right, if Messiah didn't die for this, then we are the most, what did he use the term? He used the word, most despicable of all men. The lowest of all things, if we're wrong. Most pitied, that's it. The most pitied of all people. We're the most of it because we are the most wrong you could be. Yes, Tammy.
So you can imagine, like with Eli's sons, the people knew what filthy individuals these were.
Yeah, this wasn't rumors. They knew. They could see that. Here's the tent, the open tents.
Because they were subjected to some of their, you know, bullying and everything else, and they also had to have known about their proclivities.
Yes.
So you imagine, you know you're a sinner, and so you're bringing your sin offering, and you want to be right with God. And you're thinking to yourself as you're bringing this lamb or whatever, though, it's like, yeah, I'm a sinner. I did this thing, but why am I bringing my offering to these people when they're doing stuff that's far worse than what I'm bringing this lamb for?
Right, exactly.
And how that would taint your understanding of justice and everything else, because you're bringing your lamb because of a sin, and you're bringing it to a priest who's putting his far filthier hands on it than your hands are.
Right.
And how that would just demoralize you, because you see in the story is like people didn't want to go.
Exactly, they're avoiding it because it contaminated. The word had spread out. People were fully aware of how corrupt the whole system was. So there's other things I could talk about today, but I'm going to call it. Well, there's one more thing I should bring up, just it's important not to forget. Give me a couple minutes. We'll just for a couple minutes, and then I'll stop. So let's jump real quick to I always stop eventually. Jump to there's two places. excuse me, two places of the Haftorah reading that is relevant in this topic. One of the Haftorah readings we jump to Ezekiel 36, and not read the whole section, just a percentage of it. Now this is a prophecy. So we have this story, we have these issues where there are individuals who are not good examples of priests or good people. We have people who are good examples and how God deals with each of these individuals and these offerings as well as the quick punishment or slow punishment procedure that God seems to use. So Ezekiel 36 discusses part of this, not in great detail, but does cover part of it. Right, what Tammy had just mentioned as well. So starting in verse 16 of Ezekiel 36, Moreover, the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, Son of man, when the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own ways and deeds. To me, their way was like the uncleanness of a woman in her customary impurity. Therefore, I poured out my fury on them for the blood they had shed on the land and for their idols which they had defiled. So I scattered them among the nations, and they were dispersed throughout the countries. I judged them according to their ways and their deeds. When they came to nations, wherever they went, they profaned my holy name. When they said of them, These are the people of Jehovah, yet they have gone out of his land. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations wherever they went. Therefore say to the house of Israel, Thus says Jehovah God, I do not do this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations wherever you went. And I will sanctify my great name, which has been profaned among those nations, which you have profaned in their midst, and the nations which shall know that I am Jehovah, says the Lord God, when I am hallowed before you in their eyes. For I will take you from among the nations and gather you out of the countries and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you and you shall be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. You will keep my judgments and do them. Then you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers. You shall be my people, and I will be your God. I will deliver you from all your uncleannesses. I will call for the grain and multiply it and bring no famine upon you. I will multiply the fruit of your trees and increase your fields. You need never again to bear reproach of the famine among the nations. Then you remember your evil ways, your deeds that were not good, and you will loathe yourselves in your own sight. For your iniquities and your abominations. Not for your sake do I do this, says the Lord God. Let it be known to you. Be ashamed, be confounded for your own ways, O house of Israel. So we have these examples, and we have this story which God's going to do. Now, God's methodology was relatively slow throughout various characters throughout our Torah and our Tanakh. But in this instance, he has relatively, actually, centuries long slow response with Israel, because yet today this stuff still has not fully occurred. It's been millennia, and God still, we're still waiting for these events. Now, we're going to read a little bit on the next lineup. The follow-up was in John, book of John, that follows up on this particular prophecy that Ezekiel is sharing with us. So this sequence, as I mentioned before, the high priest is categorized as a special individual with unique requirements of perfectness needed to make these events happen. And of course, this event in Ezekiel 36 discusses how God says, with the northern tribes of Israel in particular, how so awful they are, I can't handle you. And once you realize this, you won't even handle yourselves. We ourselves look at our own life and say, oh, I'm a horrible human being. Look at the awful things I've done. That's an important place to be, as opposed to, I'm good. No. You're not. That's the point. God's saying, forget that part. Look at what you've done and observe and pay attention to it, because that's how you fix, that's how you move forward. How you get, as mentioned earlier, closer to God. The closer you get, the more scrutiny is put upon us, right? We understand that. We do it for adults, we do it for everybody else. So in John, which is the follow-up to Ezekiel 36, he kind of, it's like an extension of it, so to speak. In John, I think it's chapter 11? Yeah, John 11. Discusses this in how Messiah fulfills, didn't finish, mind you, but started this process that Ezekiel spoke about, which our Torah portion has dealt with as well as the characters how God deals with individuals who are far from him versus those who are close to him. So John 11, we're going to end here in verse 47. 47 through, the end of the chapter. The chief of the priests and Pharisees gathered counsel and said, "What should we do regarding this man works many signs?" Mind you, this in the context is leading up to Messiah's death, like a week or so later. This is that they're discussing among themselves how to kill him off and what to do with him. And it's the same principle of the one man can mess up a congregation or a people, or one man can ruin a people, and how this is going to handle it. It says, "This man does many signs, works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." One of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider it that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not the whole nation should perish." Now this is not a direct quotation, but a conceptualization of what Moses had just said to Aaron. And we just read about in Korah, the same Moses conversation with God. One man being guilty, should one man affect everybody, or should one man save everybody? These are the two examples. Let's continue on. "Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus, of course, would die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together," this is the reference to Ezekiel, "gather together in one the children of God who are scattered abroad. And then from that day, they plotted to put him to death. Therefore, of course, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there, the countryside, the wilderness, to a city called Ephraim, and he remained with his disciples." I'm not going to finish off all of this part. So we have this example of the high priest Aaron and his two sons being struck dead immediately. Well, Aaron was, but his two sons were immediately for their offense. They were the closest to God, and so God's leeway of saying, "Well, let's work with this with warnings or try to guide them or help them along," there was none. There was an immediate strike. That was it. And also with Uzzah, it was he reached his hand out and touched. It was immediate. There is no warning time. You are the closest to God. You don't get the warnings. You don't have the massive leeways. The further away you got away from God, the more leeway and more time God gave you to a warning to guide you back. It's no different than a young child versus an adult. You have more young children you are more lenient with than adults are. The same principle applies. So go through this process. We can see how it happens. With Eli and his sons, God gave decades-long warnings of ours, how to repair their lives, come back, improve, do better. Of course, they failed eventually. So they died. And then we went on, we also had mentioned Elijah and a whole nation going generationally wise with Elijah's time where he thought everyone was dead. No one survived. God had them all killed off, but yet God said, no, don't worry. There's 7,000 to set aside. Go back to work. We have things to do. You're not done yet. Keep going. And Elijah's saying, "Well, God, isn't this enough? Isn't it awful enough?" And God said, no. It's not even close. Keep going. So they have a lot of leeway that God gave to the northern tribe of Israel in that capacity. And of course, also we learned from Ezekiel's example that God's saying, Israel's so awful, but it's not because of them that I'm going to fix this problem. It's strictly because when they left, they took my name with them and profaned it over there. Okay, I can't have that happen either. Instead of just killing them off, I'll bring them back, but I will put inside them a notion or a heart that they will realize that what they've done, and they in their own eyes will see how awful of humans they actually are. They will, as it says, they will loathe themselves in their own sight of what they have been, and that will be enough to correct or help them, and of course, obviously, elevate God's name. And of course, also in the book of John, this discusses the process which that procedure was going to happen, of course, through Messiah in his death, that one man would perish. Of course, the people would cover not just the people of Israel, but nations and scatter them all and bring them all back. We discussed those sequences. We also discussed today, in particular, the high priest's character himself. The role itself was so critical that no individual could make any errors or mistakes in it. Else, it affects everybody. As we mentioned, we gave the example, of course, with Eli and his sons, but also Aaron. So he wasn't allowed to mess his hair up or do anything else out to mourn the loss of his sons because his station was so critically important. So both these things are parallel going going on. The closer you are, God requires more of you. And the station itself is very, very important to him as far as what the job is. So both those things affect. Because in Korah's example, his station was low, though his actions were physically acceptable. His station was very low. So he himself, and of course the people with him, were struck with that, but the whole nation wasn't. So we said that the station has to be characterized well. That tells us, combining all those two parallel ideas together, that the closer you are to God and the station you hold affects how God reacts to you, or how he handles you and he deals with you in your life. So the closer you are to him, you are inviting more scrutiny. And the more greater position you are given or you're in, the more important it is that you are watchful of that behavior and that scrutiny, because it affects other people. The broader it is. It's no different than a parent being a corrupt individual, and guess what? The children become corrupt, and we say, "What? How'd that happen?" It's not shocking. The parent held a guiding hand and it guided the children into that corrupt pathway. No different. So that high priest role is important. But the closer you are to God, the more important the scrutiny is that God puts upon you, and the less leeway in saying, well, relaxing, so to speak, of your crazy, weird things that you do. God is not so forgiving of those. He said, wait a minute, I expected more of you because I gave you more. Your position was more important. You came closer to me. You're wanting to come closer to me. You were elevated up. I expect more of you. And hence, we have our Messiah, which had to be the perfect individual, else all of our sins are still upon us. We're screwed up. A perfect individual for that application, but also the high priest position, both had to be well done. And God doesn't say, oh, Messiah, you made a mistake, it's okay. No, that wouldn't work, because it would have to be an immediate death if he made any errors, because otherwise this whole process is a waste. Does that make sense? It hopefully makes sense. So in our Torah portion, we examine these types of characteristics. So the closer that you and I try to get to God, guess what happens? The closer he looks at us. And sometimes that's a great thing. And sometimes, like, well, you know, can I hide this part of me? Thanks. Yeah, you shouldn't see that section. Let's look at something else. Oh, look at the birds. You know, something else. To avoid him looking too closely. That's a problem, though, because he sees everything. The point is, the closer you get, more scrutiny is involved. He expects more, because to more is given, more is expected. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Yes, Rose.
Came and redeemed us, so therefore he bought the whole house. And that does not mean I get to keep the garage. That means he gets the whole house.
Okay.
And one other thought, I was thinking that just because you say in your mind, well, if I stay away from God, you know, he's not going to bother me so much.
Doesn't work that way.
But let be warned that time runs out. Mm-hmm. And yep. Once you've used up all your time, there's no going back.
You can't go back and fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my thing is to draw close to him, because my time's running out.
You would
out,
need to.
And I want to be there.
Because when you only have one life to live, to learn your lessons and go as far as you can, however, whenever it ends, it ends. So it's all those records and all those lessons you learn is in that lifetime. Once you're perished, whether or not you get resurrected or not, you can't go back and fix what you did. You can't go back and relearn, oh, well, I'll redo that. In spite of what the movies and TV shows say, you can't actually do that. It doesn't work that way. No matter how hard you try. Yes, Tammy.
I have this T-shirt that I came this close to wearing to services today, and I didn't do it. And now I'm kind of regretting it. Because the T-shirt says, we must die before we die, so that when we die, we won't die.
That is absolutely true, and that's a cute T-shirt. Cute T-shirt. Yes, Cher. You don't understand that? So help her to explain it.
While we only have this life, there's one life, and then there's judgment, right? So we die. If we die to self now, then when we physically die, we won't spiritually die. But if we do not die to self now, then when we physically die, we will also spiritually die.
All right, let's close in prayer. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for a Shabbat, a day of rest, a day of studying and learning what is good and right in your eyes. Father, please help us be good servants to you, good examples, to strive to get closer to you, Father, for you are where our blessings come from. We ask you will bless those who love you and call upon your name, Father, who do their best to examine themselves and see where there is error and ask you for you to help them. Give them strength, give us strength, give us all strength to make those decisions and pursue you in that way. But we ask you to bless us the rest of our Shabbat, our time with each other, to share and to fellowship. We praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.